Hello and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who, thanks to the BBC makeup department, can't actually blink because of all this stuff on our faces. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I understand we all sound the same.
We are heading back to the 1890s, both in terms of story setting and racial politics, for The Talents of Weng Chiang.
I just want to talk about the elephant that is in the room, and that is John Bennett as Lee Seng Chang, taking a Caucasian man and putting yellow face on him for this serial. What the hell were they thinking? And I say this now, like in 2015. I guess the thing is this, I look back at my childhood and I didn't even realise as a small child that he was in yellow face. I didn't, you know, and for many years I didn't at all. And even when I did come to that realisation, probably in my late teens, like I was a bit slow on the uptake, I still didn't see it as being a problem. Now I see it as being quite a big problem. Personally, I'd love to know what John Bennett thought about doing this, what the Chinese members of the cast thought about this actually happening, what UK fans thought of it at the time. I mean, we know that the Canadians did not show this particular serial. I'd love to know what Doctor Who fans who are non-Caucasian actually think about this. I'd love to know what new Who fans who come to this show from the new series actually think about this when they see it. I just find it really hard to sort of take myself away from that 10-year-old kid. You know, I lived in a suburb here in Australia at the time in the late 1970s where there weren't Chinese people. We had one Chinese restaurant. To go to McDonald's, you had to actually travel two suburbs away. You know, this is my world at the time. So I find it really hard to be completely outraged to the nth degree. You know, I watch this now and I go, what were they thinking? But then I sort of get over it and I go, well, he's always been Lee Seng Chang to me. That's just him. And I think it's a great performance and I just get on with it. But I can totally understand if people are completely and utterly, you know, outraged. And I'd love to know, I mean, please post some comments in the on the website. I really would like to know. You guys?
Yeah, well, people really push back against the idea that the Doctor Who is racist. And it's because, you know, we love Doctor Who. It's part of our childhood. Talents of Weng Chiang is a massively enjoyable and well-made story. And so we don't want to think of it as being racist. And we've had conversations online since starting the podcast. You know, we identified Celestial Toymaker as racist and the Ark as racist. And I think they fairly clearly are, but people don't want to admit it, do you know what I mean? And will tie themselves in all sorts of interpretive knots to get away from it. And so you constantly hear, oh, there weren't any Chinese people in 1976, and so they just had to slap some fake epicanthic folds on John Bennett and point him in the direction of the camera. And I just don't think that's good enough. Like, I don't believe that there wasn't a Chinese actor available. He looks ridiculous. I mean, he just looks ridiculous. And there are, exactly your point, I think, is a really good one. There are Chinese cast members, do you know what I mean, standing around him. What on earth must they be thinking? And I think the problem with the story, look, I mean, I do at some point want to get on to how great it is, and there are some really good things to say about it.
Yeah.
But the story is really, it's not just John Bennett, but it's the racism of the story.
Like, in our intro, I said, I understand we all sound the same, but he actually says, I understand we all look the same. I mean,
when in fact, Lee Seng Chang, you don't look like any Asian person who has ever existed.
And you know, people say, well, that's him mocking the Europeans. Do you know what I mean? And people point out that Casey is a stereotype as well. You know, he's a drunken, superstitious Irishman who's sort of cowardly and irrational and all of that sort of thing. And that Jago is a stereotype as well. Do you know what I mean?
And like, even Lightfoot to an extent.
Yeah, he's kind of, you know, a bit like Dr. Watson or something like that. But, you know, those stereotypes who are us, do you know what I mean, who are white British people like the members of the audience, they can't be as kind of negative cutting as the stereotypes of the other. And so people say, oh, you know, Chang's a very sympathetic character, he's very smart, you know, all of those sorts of things, and he plays on the stereotypes. And we see him being kind of racist. You know, when he performs on stage, he does that shockingly embarrassing accent with the R's and the L's, you know, and he does the, you know, one of us is yellow line and stuff like that. And all of that is sort of just butt-clenchingly embarrassing now. But people say, well, you know, he's mocking the racism of the era and things. But
I don't think it comes across like that at all.
No. I mean, this is what people say, and there is something to be said for the character is a stage performer. He has a stage accent, which is more Chinese than, more kind of stereotype Chinese than the actual accent. But the fact of the matter is it's a white guy in makeup doing a Chinese accent, and so it just sort of falls flat.
Yeah, exactly. So Chang's ironic asides, if you like, work on paper. If the character is being played by a Chinese actor, or if at the end of episode 5, when he dies, he reveals that as a character inside the show, he's a white guy wearing a mask.
That would have been great.
Oh, wow. You know,
the rat chews off his mask to reveal
that would, you know,
John Bennett. Hi, I'm John.
It's a bit like later on in Power of Kroll, where we have a really rubbish representation of Kroll at the end of episode 1, and it turns out it's a guy in a crap suit.
Yeah,
and it's
probably
meant to be a guy in a crap suit.
Probably looks more convincing from the front.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as far as it goes, if you like, I think John Bennett gives the best performance he can.
Yeah.
But the whole concept is working against an acceptable performance of the character.
The character is racist. All this stuff about him being a sympathetic character. He's a sinister Chinaman who kind of lurks around the place, abducting women from the streets and handing them over to his master to be murdered. Do you know what I mean? That's not that sympathetic, you know.
And that's another problem I have with this story, is that all these women are being killed. Why does Gruul have to have young women? Why can't it just be anybody? Right, is it Gruul? Oh, sorry. I'm getting a bit confused with a play I once did.
I'm bringing that up.
We once did, I should say. Sorry. That's another plot point that I just think is just unbelievable, that it's, you know, it's not equal opportunity death here. It's like, you know, it's only young women who are scantily clad that get murdered.
And again, people say, well, you know, this is set in the Victorian era and it's playing with Victorian era stereotypes and it's a Jack the Ripper analogue and all of that. And English people were very racist about Chinese people in the 1890s and stuff like that. But, you know, that's not really good enough.
No.
And, you know, let's take a look at the Crimson Horror from just a couple of years ago in the new series. You know, it had a strong female villain and female characters and stuff, and still played with all of those stereotypes, but without... There are two speaking women, as usual for a Hinchcliffe story. In fact, this is the big renaissance of feminism in the Hinchcliffe era, where for two stories in a row, we've had two speaking women parts. One of them is the ghoul who sees them pulling the body from the thing and says, oh, you wouldn't want that served up with onions. You know, her. And then the other is a prostitute who gets, you know, kidnapped off the street by the sympathetic Lee Sen Chang, and then, oh, she does escape, I think, doesn't she? She doesn't actually.
Yeah. Well, Leela saves her.
So the representation of women is just terrible, and it's just not good enough, I think, to say, oh, we're just using these old stereotypes and we're not going to re-examine them. And it's Bob Holmes. Do you know what I mean? Bob Holmes is very lazy about that, and it's what gave us the all-male cast of Pyramids of Mars, because he doesn't bother to re-examine, you know, those stereotypes and freshen them and do something more interesting with them. He's just content to fall back on them. You know, it's what gives us the racism in Pyramids of Mars, you know, with all the superstitious, savage Egyptians, you know, running away and being patronized by the white guy. And you know, sure, Holmes makes fun of colonialism and makes fun of those white guys, but what he doesn't do is a critique of colonialism, and what he does is just unthinkingly repeat these stereotypes. It's not just Lee Sen Chang either. Like, all of our characters, all of the sympathetic characters, from Lightfoot to Jago to the Doctor and Leela, all say things that we would regard as racist. Do you know what I mean? Mm. So there's, you know, Jago talks about the celestial Chang. We get, you know, more Wongs for the Tong from Jago. Lightfoot refers to the Chinese people as devils, you know. the Doctor and Leela talk about little men. Leela calls Chang the Yellow One. And Sandifer points this out, even when at the very end in episode 6, where all of Greel's Chinese men come in to get the Doctor, the Doctor makes this joke, life's full of little surprises. Do you know what I mean? And at that point he says, I'm not even going to bother working out whether that's deliberately racist or not, but the Doctor calls them all little men in episode yes. one. You know, like, all of that stuff is just so, it's just done so thoughtlessly.
Yeah.
I think Nathan, just to sort of counterpoint that, you've had a previous script editor, I think, in Terence Dix, who probably was pretty much aware of that sort of thing. I mean, I think if we look at British television throughout the 1970s, there is so much sexism and racism in sitcoms, and Doctor Who actually comes across really quite well compared to all of those things. But Bob Holmes does not have the moral compass to be able to moderate himself as well as, I think, the previous script editor on this account. And I think it's also really easy to apply where we are now with what we think is acceptable and not, like to productions now, and you're talking about the Crimson Horror and how all that's done. Back in the 1970s, that's not the culture that's around. So I think it's much harder to be able to, and Doctor Who on the most part has been able to not be as racist. So here, yes, you've put up all these points about all this racism in all of these aspects, and I don't think all of those things are necessarily extremely racist, like in intent. I think some are much more than others. Like if you take a few in isolation, I think the intent is there to send it up. But then as they add up, that intent diminishes, and so it comes across much more racist than what it actually is.
If you look at Marco Polo, for instance, you know what I mean? Like, again, there's lots of sort of characters in Yellowface, and it does seem a bit less offensive in black and white for some reason. But you've got Xenia Merton and stuff, and there's a sort of sympathetic portrayal of a whole range of different characters. I think the guy in Mind of Evil, the Chinese delegate, is great.
Yes.
And he's treated very well. There are some slightly, there's only one Chinese woman in London in that story, obviously. But, you know, otherwise that's sort of pretty good. I think the story in Tibet, Abominable Snowmen, again, do you know what I mean? Like, it's a bit colonial.
Despite the fact they're all sort of white guys and most of them are Welsh. You know, it's still a sympathetic portrayal.
It's slightly dodgy by modern characteristics, but it's certainly streets ahead of Talons of Wang Chiang. So I think you're right. I think that Holmes, it is possible for Doctor Who, even in the 70s, not to be as racist as this. Do you know what I mean? So even comparing it against earlier shows, I think it comes off worse.
Yes, no, I do agree.
Something that's interesting then is modern reappraisals. So, of course, we mentioned earlier at the time, TV Ontario just didn't show Talons of Wang Chiang, and a lot of Canadian TV stations didn't show it after a complaint from Canadian, Chinese and Asian groups. Now, if we look back to the 90s, one of the sort of seminal Doctor Who research works that came out was The Discontinuity Guide by Paul Cornell, Martin Day and Keith Topping. Here's what they have to say about racism in Talons of Wang Chiang. One of the great moments of Doctor Who history, an effortless conquering of the pseudo-historical genre with a peerless script. The story features another classic Robert Holmes double act, the theatrical Henry Jago and Professor Lightfoot, although they don't actually meet until episode 5, spending the previous episodes taking turns at playing Watson or Lestrade to the Doctor's Sherlock. Oh wait, they don't mention it. Meanwhile, 10 years later, in Doctor Who the Television Companion by David J. Howe, it's the characters that really make the Talons of Wang Chiang shine. John Bennett is faultless as the inscrutable Lee Sen Chang, and his performance and makeup are so convincing that it is difficult to believe he is not actually Chinese.
It really isn't that difficult. Maybe he hasn't met any Chinese people.
I have a great deal of respect for David J. Howe, but yeah, I think he's never met a Chinese person.
And my 10-year-old self would have agreed with that. Yeah. Not my 40-year-old self.
Exactly. Yeah, and I think if people are going to talk about this story honestly, they have to acknowledge that there was a time where they didn't see a problem with it.
Yeah.
And that's my perspective. There was a time when I never saw a problem. And for many years. You're younger than us. Were your experiences any different?
Well, I was just going to say that when I was at primary school, I had a lot of friends who were Chinese or Vietnamese or Japanese from various parts of Asia originally. And I don't think my young self saw a white man in yellow face, you know?
Yeah.
It wasn't until, as with you, Todd, it wasn't until I got older that I saw, you know, that it was a white man in makeup.
But I still wasn't necessarily outraged. I mean, we had about one Chinese family in the entire school when I was in primary school.
I'm not outraged, but I'm uncomfortable with it. And I'm uncomfortable with it for the sake of, you know what, when people think of Asian actors in the UK in the 60s and 70s, they immediately think Bert Kwok.
Who will be in Doctor Who.
Who will be in Doctor Who. And was active at this time. And, you know, if people come back and say, oh, maybe he wasn't available. Okay, maybe he wasn't available. But he's not Captain Chin Lee. He's not the only Chinese person in London. You know, there's got to have been someone who was actually Chinese. Or even Japanese or Korean or Vietnamese, an actual Asian actor they could have got in there. Because another racial controversy recently was the casting of John Cho as Sulu in the Star Trek films, because he's not Japanese. But when George Takei, the original Sulu, was asked about it, George Takei said, I have no problem with him playing a Japanese character, because Sulu does not represent Japan. Sulu represents the whole of Asia.
Yeah, yeah.
And right. No one from Asia was on television when Sulu came about. And he's like, I've got no problem with anyone from Asia playing Sulu.
Yeah, well, I mean, if they could face John Bennett with some latex eyebrows, do you know what I mean? Like, I'm sure that no one would have been at home thinking, I think he might actually come from Japan.
You know? Look, I'm really glad that we've had this discussion about this, and I hope that it makes the listeners out there think about things.
Or switch off, probably.
Well, you know, either way, but you know, just
skewering their sacred cow.
But I really would be interested to actually read some more feedback from other people this. I really would. I'd love to now talk about some of the positives in this story.
You know? We do have another 10 minutes we can do. Yeah. I think we really should.
I want to go with Jago and Lightfoot, in particular Lightfoot, who I just adore as a character, and his reactions with Leela, especially when she's eating. Just wonderful. I just loved him as a kid. I just, you know, he was this doctor professor who, well, he just is this gentleman, and I just really, really liked him. Jago, on the other hand, I could have just, like, killed within the first 10 minutes of the story. One of these buffoons that I just loathe in Doctor Who, like the pirate captain and, no, just over-the-top performances. I really don't like them to begin with. But by episode 5, when he admits that he's afraid, that's when I really loved the character.
Yes.
And then going back and watching it again, like, you know, I still, like, the first few episodes, it's like, oh, my goodness. But I just love him by the end.
It's Holmes's brilliant dialogue as well. Do you know what I mean? He, everything he says is so funny. I think he's terrific, and the two of them are amazing. And Cornell, Day and Topping say, it's always a surprise to see them not actually meet until midway through episode 5.
Yeah, because you feel like they're together for the whole story.
Yeah.
And, of course, when they do meet, it's this whole British class system happening again. Because Lightfoot happens to be cleaning something at the time, he must be a butler and therefore must be spoken down to and get me your master, etc., etc. It's completely understandable how Christopher Benjamin and Trevor Baxter are still playing the characters to this day in Big Finish. And, of course, we're soon to have Jago and Lightfoot and Strax.
That's going to be something.
Which is going to be insane. It's a combination of the script and, really, the two actors giving it their all as well. You know, they create these perfectly rounded characters, and they have that nuance, like you mentioned, Todd, of Jago admitting his fear at the end there. And that scene, it's kind of a replay of a scene we discussed in Planet of the Daleks. You know, courage isn't a matter of not being scared. It's being scared and doing what you have to do anyway. But it doesn't have the Terry Nation sledgehammer approach. You know, in that scene, you had Pertwee sort of dictating what courage was. This is Jago and Lightfoot discussing and coming to a conclusion together on what courage is, and more so what fear is. And it's a real defining moment for the two of them.
Speaking of fear, as a child, I was absolutely, absolutely mortified by Mr. Sim. Like, I was terrified. Terrified. I had nightmares. I think it's a fantastic performance.
It's a terrific character too, isn't it? Just the way he goes out of control in episode seeks and virtually just kills Grail, you know, and the laugh and all of that sort of thing. It's really, really great. Yeah. And just the whole look of the doll and everything, even the dialogue between him and Chang on stage is terrifically funny. Like, I think he's great. I think the production here is just spectacular. And it's something, you know, the BBC, we've said it before, can do period stuff. The Victorian stuff it can do really well, but they're just throwing stacks of money at it. So they've got some great locations on film. They've got night shoots, you know, like they've got OB stuff, you know, like
handheld stuff.
In the theatre on videotape. Yeah. Lightfoot, some laboratories on videotape, you know, in a location. There's stuff outdoors, I think, that's on OB camera as well. So the whole thing is really lavish and really expensive. Lots of shooting at night. It's really, really atmospheric. Like the story goes that Hinchcliffe knew that he was going and just thought, we'll spend next year's budget as well. So when you're watching Invisible Enemy next year, you'll know why.
I even like the haystack.
So do we know this story? Someone didn't move their car before shooting, and so they're stuck with the location that they want to shoot in, and there's a car in the middle of it, so they just cover it with hay.
They put a tarpaulin over it first, so it didn't get hay in the gear shift.
They shouldn't have done that.
Just coming back to something you were saying earlier, all that work in the theatre and the chase sequence in the theatre, it's Walsh Watch.
Oh, again, is it?
Really? We've got Terry doubling for Tom in some of that, like the swing over and whatnot. Terry and Stuart Fell doubling for Tom and Michael Spice, the lesser-known Spice Girl.
He was Morbius, of course, last year.
Yes, he was. That also made me think of another favourite moment I have for Lightfoot. It's when Leela comes down in her new dress after she's been through her ordeal in the sewers. And we'll get onto the giant rat in a moment.
No, can we get onto the dress in a moment?
Yeah. But she comes down in this dress and Trevor Baxter's reaction as Lightfoot. There have been many allegations and suggestions that Leela was brought in to boost the show's sex appeal. So it would be very easy for Trevor Baxter to play that scene as an older man in lust after a younger woman. But that is not how the scene comes across. He looks like a proud father.
But don't you think it's like Henry Higgins and Colonel Pickering going off arm in arm to buy a lovely dress for a woman?
Oh, absolutely. And I've seen Rupert Everett as Henry Higgins. So that's definitely happening there.
So, Nathan, you wanted to talk about Leela and the rat?
Well, I want to talk about the dress. Do you know what I mean? And
that dress or the dress that she's wearing when she's menaced by the rat?
Well, we'll talk about it. It'll all come up. It's all big thing.
Here we go. Yep.
So, it's all very frock.
We've seen 8 episodes where Leela's written by Chris Boucher, and he writes her as someone who's intelligent, as we said, but instinctual, do you know what I mean? Mm. Who quickly grasps things the doctor tells her and is smart and intelligent. She dismisses the doctor's explanation of the TARDIS as, you know, dimensional transcendental illness. I meant to say that. Do you know what I mean? As silly. You know, she's not stupid at all. But in this story, I think she's completely defanged, and she's written as an idiot, and she's also written as a purely peril monkey, do you know what I mean? As someone in peril. And so we see her racing through the sewers in her transparent undies. Do we see some nipple there, Todd?
Possibly, yes.
She screams when the Tong attack her. Do you know what I mean? She's really fairly useless in that scene. All of the stuff about her not understanding Victorian morals and etiquette and stuff, maybe with the exception of the really good conversation about tea in episode 6, is her being kind of stupid and slow on the uptake, and just the pride with which she shows off her new dress. Do you know what I mean? Like, she's just turned into such a girly girl, and it just enrages me that she's so defanged in this story by Holmes.
I'm sorry, I can't agree at all. Okay, yes, when she's attacked by the Tong, she screams, because there's 6 of them.
She's Leela, do you know what I mean?
Well, exactly. Later on, she's killing people with Janus thorns because they're trying to attack the Doctor. The whole reason she gets captured by Lee Sen Chang is because she saves someone else to put herself in danger. The stuff about the Victorian etiquette is sending up Victorian etiquette, like when she picks up the bone to eat and starts eating with
their hands.
Well,
I don't think it's sending up Victorian etiquette because we have the same things. Do you know what I mean? We eat with knives and forks and you don't pick the food up out of your thing.
But,
and in fact, Lightfoot comes across as a gentleman, you know, confronted by an idiot. Do you know what I mean? And he's being very lovely about it.
But here's the thing, right? In our modern culture, we might say to someone, oh, no, you know, it's much better if you eat with a knife and fork. The reason that Lightfoot starts eating with his hands as well is, in Victorian culture, you would not embarrass your guest. You would not point out a faux pas. You wouldn't invite them around again. That's what you do. But he would not embarrass them by pointing out where they got it wrong. And that's stupid.
Leela does step in when she goes to wipe her face on the tablecloth.
The thing is, she doesn't mind that. No. She goes, oh, okay, that's the proper thing to do. Whereas if he'd done that before and said, oh, if you use this, Leela adapts to situations she's in and she does kind of respond to that kind of feedback of, oh, this is what you do. And that's what I think the dress is about. I don't think she is necessarily proud of the dress.
Oh, but look at her face. It's embarrassing.
Because the professor has shown her kindness and hospitality. And it shows that even though she is not cultured in the sense of the Victorian era, she is cultured in a way that you show gratitude to people who have shown you kindness. So I still think she is a very strong character in this because she's arriving at the same conclusions as everyone else, but through a different method. And when the doctor's explaining the science of, like, the Sigma beam, you know, she does the Futurama thing of putting too much air in a balloon. You mean there's a hole in the water bag and the hole is getting bigger. She completely understands the science first thing.
See, the dress is a picture for me of someone who is getting male approval for being a proper girly for the first time and really enjoying that. And so it just sees her put in a proper feminine box where Holmes wants her. It does set my teeth on edge, I'm afraid.
I'm not as outraged as you, Nathan, on these matters. I probably is somewhere in between. I can see both points of view. It's the whole screaming from the rat and that sequence, which I think really defangs her. But the other stuff, I actually think that she's quite natural in that, and I don't really have a problem with it.
I think she's better, spoiler alert, next week in Horror of Fang Rock. Do you know what I mean? I think she's a lot better, and she is given a girly counterpoint, do you know what I mean, whom she can be better than. But there is a tendency, I think, in the following season to shed the Boucher characterisation and just write her as an idiot.
Now, we've mentioned the rat.
It's so bad! That scene... That first scene when you see it and it's a tiny rat crawling through like a toilet roll representation of the sewer tunnel.
I like the way it sort of bounces along.
But it's impossible to tell that the actual miniature rat inside the miniature tunnel, that's supposed to be a giant rat.
Yeah, you can't tell. Yeah.
It's not shot from below.
No sense of scale.
Oh, so I just thought it was one of the rats in the sewer.
No, it's meant to be the giant rats. You see, that's how poor it is. And then the other one, which looks like it's just come fresh from a rat hair salon. Do you know what I mean? So it's, you know, and I'm sure that someone else pointed this out. You know, I'm not the first to say this, but its hair just looks like nylon. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
and like, its teeth look like Basil Brush's front teeth. It doesn't look remotely, and the way that it bounces up and down is just absurd. And we do see this with Holmes, where Holmes is much more interested in writing about people, and that's a good thing. Do you know what I mean? And so in Power of Kroll, there's one big monster. In Rebus Operation, there's the Shriven Zal. In Caves of Androzani, there's the magma creature. You know, he'll very frequently just throw in, even Carnival of Monsters has, you know, drashigs and stuff, but essentially the idea is he'll throw in a monster just to placate us because it's Doctor Who, but essentially he's more interested in people, and that's good, that's laudable, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I just sort of wonder what the rat's there for. It would so easily, the story would have coped without the rat.
That's right. What do we think of Michael Spicer's performance as Bentface?
Sometimes I think he's a bit over the top, but he does have quiet moments as well. That moment in, is it episode 5 or 6, where he actually has his first meeting with the Doctor and they sit down at Lightfoot's table and talk about the situation.
Is it the one where the Doctor looks up and suddenly notices that he's there?
Yeah, exactly.
He's talking to Leela, he sits down and he looks up and it's Greel sitting next to him. And that conversation is great, isn't it?
Yeah. I think that's a wonderful conversation. But then you get scenes like,
the
fool! A time agent would not ask such questions, or whatever it is.
It's the usual thing that Holmes does, where the villains call everyone really rude names.
Fools!
Yeah.
Like, I just love the way,
let the talons of Wang Chiang shred your flesh!
And I just can't watch that anymore without bursting into laughter, because many years ago, Nathan and I were involved in a little Doctor Who play for a convention here in Sydney, and a good friend of ours, Simon Moore.
Friend of the podcast,
Simon Moore, portrayed Mangus Greel. And the way he delivered that line, I never really registered at the time that that's the way it was delivered in the show. And so I now watch this show, and there's just so much stuff that
Simon was doing,
and that friend of the podcast, Peter Griffiths, who wrote the script, like just sends up and just twists the lines. And I just sit there laughing my head off when I know that I shouldn't be.
I will also just point out that play, which was called There's Something About Magnus, the Guy Who Drained Me, that play is superior to this story in at least one respect.
Oh, I think we had an actual Chinese person in it.
There was an actual Asian actor playing Lee Sen Chang. And I do recall there was a wonderful moment where you had Simon as Magnus Greel, and I never knew the man.
Was it Anthony Yee?
Yeah.
Anthony Yee as Lee Sen Chang. Greel is giving him a telling off, like, you fool, you dolt, you, and Chang just says, inscrutable Asian stereotype, you inscrutable Asian stereotype. And I remember that I think got the second biggest laugh. I think the first biggest laugh was Sylvester McCoy playing Joe Grant.
My God, the things we did. He is Joe Grant, and then, of course, the lovely Nicola Bryant as, well, the ultimate Mangus Greel.
And I do remember the next day, Casey wasn't at the convention that day. She was at the convention the second day and found out they did a play. And she's turned, oh, you did a play. Were you in it, Sylvester? Oh, yes, I was you, darling. Oh, haven't we all been, darling?
Oh, God, they were good sports. So the legacy of Holmes Hinchcliffe, here we are.
Yeah, oh, this good is the plan. End. Yeah.
Now, I just want to say this. 21 episodes of this season are in the top 25 shows of the week, which is, you know, a significant uptick. Mm. Over the last few years, it's been building. I think there's like 13 episodes the previous 2 years. Right. And even in John's last season, I think there's 12 episodes that are in the top 25. And so really since season 10, Doctor Who has been moving from top 30, top 25, and this year, you know, into, you know, the top 20 even more so. But it's all about to change. Tom's only had one episode outside the top 50. Only 10 of his episodes over these three seasons are, in fact, outside the top 30.
Right.
Starting from next year, there are only 16 more episodes of Doctor Who that are inside the top 30.
Like ever?
Like ever.
Wow.
15 of those are up to the end of the Graham Williams era in The Horns of Nymon. And only The Horns of Nymon Part 4 and Episode 1 of Time Flight for the 1980s, there are only two episodes that are in the top 30.
Goodness.
And the only episode remaining that the Doctor Who makes the top 20 is City of Death, Episode 4.
Because the other side was on strike.
Well, that's true. But there's a significant shift. Next year, for the first time since Season 7, there is not a single episode of Doctor Who inside the top 20.
Wow.
There's only two episodes of The Horror of Fraggle Rock that make it to number 23. And nothing else in the top 25. So there's a significant shift in Doctor Who's audience starting from the beginning of next season. And this is before people know about Graham Williams or lack of budgets robot dogs or whatever you want to say. But there's a change. And people will choose after this story not to come back and watch the show in the same numbers. Now, I'm being very dramatic. Over the next 3 years, there's still many episodes of Doctor Who between 30 and 50th. And in Davison's first year as well. But what was once building and building and building, which really started in the second half of John Pertwee's second series, where the show shifted into the top 30 for the first time in a long time, it's suddenly moving back out of the top 20, 25. Is this the legacy of the Holmes Hinchcliffe era? And why is that the case? Now, we've discussed things, previously about characterization. Sarah, for example, becoming less real, that audience identification, is it that?
You know, it is this thing where it takes a while. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not, people decided not to tune into The Invisible Enemy because they thought it would be terrible. Do you know what I mean? It has to be a response to previous things.
That's right.
I think people rightly regard the Hinchcliffe era as a high point for the show just because of the look at it, of it, and, you know, the writing and stuff. It is really effective. So I don't know that I want to lay... Certainly the stuff in the 80s, you know, there's no way that that's directly a result of people switching off during Hinchcliffe. You know, I think the 80s...
Oh, no, but what I'm saying is that there is a change.
Yeah.
Right? It's not must-see TV for all of that audience anymore.
Well, Sandifer, in his entry on The Invisible Enemy, talks about really the slow slide to cancellation that sort of kicks in there. And part of it is Hinchcliffe's fault, you know, in that the show is excessively violent and comes under much greater scrutiny. Some of it's the fault of the economy, do you know what I mean? Oh, well, Hinchcliffe's fault in that he spends all the money on Talons of Wang Chiang and leaves Williams with a reduced budget. But some of it's economical, do you know what I mean? Mm. That there's massive inflation and the money doesn't go very far. And so suddenly Doctor Who starts to look really ropey.
But I mean, and the counterpoint, you know, episode 4 of Underworld, which we know is not
very good
in terms of money-wise, is the highest rated episode next season in terms of viewers.
Mm.
Like, there's no logic to necessarily logical reason. And so I'm hoping that's something that you guys will explore during, you know, next year and you know, reflecting on where we've been with Holmes and Hinchcliffe and where Holmes and Wayans will go. Mm.
I think it's a good point. I think we are entering a sort of long death march now. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'll be saying tiresome a lot more often, I think, probably from here on in.
I lay the blame on something very simple. Star Wars.
Mm.
And Graham Williams, and I think Anthony Reed and Tom Baker went to see Star Wars and came out and essentially said, oh, four-letter word.
We're screwed.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
Because this is now the first time that people can find their sci-fi heroes on the big screen,
yeah,
yes,
and have a new avenue, whereas Doctor Who has been that conduit for cult sort of television superhero sort of thing in Britain, and now there's going to be a shift.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's a bit of a downer. I didn't want it to be like that, but I just wanted to bring up that there was this change.
We've had
this super success, and this season has been extraordinary.
Yeah,
Not one episode outside the top 40 for the whole season.
Right. So on that note of a steady decline, we slide into our Jenny Laird Awards. Nathan, would you like to go first?
Well, I mean, I hate to be really obvious, but it just has to be the Rat, doesn't it? Like, we've gone on about the Rat, but the Rat, you know, I've been roundly critical of Talons of Wang Chiang, but it is incredibly well made. Do you know what I mean? It looks spectacular and expensive. It's just terrific, but the Rat is just the worst thing in the entire season. And Holmes must have known that they weren't... This is the man who called, you know, the lizard monsters from Carnival of Monsters the Drashigs because it was an anagram of dish rag. And he thought that that's what they would be made of. He's got to have known that the production team wasn't going to be able to pull off anything like a convincing giant rat.
Yes.
And a story that has the things leading up to the giant rat, the scene where the Doctor's on the boat, do you know what I mean, with the elephant gun, heading into the Fleet River, just looks incredible, you know, like as good as Doctor Who has ever, ever, ever looked. And it's a giant, giant sore point in the entire story.
And what's amazing is around the same time, the new Avengers actually do a better giant rat than Doctor Who in the episode Gnaws.
Is it good? Should we seek it out?
It's okay. It's okay. A lot of people don't like it, but you've got to realise that it's a parody of Jaws with the least likely animal possible.
Oh, so G-N-A-W-S. Gnaws. Brilliant. Genius.
Okay, my Jenny Laird Award has to go to... Where are all the women of Gallifrey in The Deadly Assassin? Why is Gallifrey entirely populated with men? Where are all the women?
It's a Hinchcliffe story?
Well, even so, you know, you would think that there'd be some logical thought of there must be some women somewhere. As we discussed with Deadly Assassin, you know, I don't have a big problem with the way the Time Lord Society is presented as stagnant and defeat and what have you. But where are the women? That's my Jenny Laird.
I think that's really, really good. Where are the women?
Where are
I'm just going to say, that's my genuine reward. Where are the women, Bob? Where are the women?
Where are the women, Phil, too?
Yes.
The entire Hinchcliffe era, it's just appalling. And either side, do you know, Nina will start to get more women in Graham Williams?
Either that or it has to be the Tesh costumes. That's the other thing. I'm going to think, okay, that might supersede. Well, you can decide.
If it's a eugenics, I think I said this last time, if it's a eugenics experiment, why are they all men? Like, how are the Tesh breeding?
Where are the women? So, hold on, let's do a quick count. So, we've got Hilda Winters, we've got Vyra, no one in Sontaran Experiment, we've got Betan.
Yep.
Yes.
No one in Revenge. Sister Lamont.
Yes.
She counts as being a named character. No one in
Pyramids
or Planet of Evil.
Yep.
We've got Tessa.
Just.
I love Tessa.
Yeah.
She's Miss Paget for the late 70s.
Yeah. We've got Ahika and Marin. They're the only two named ones, I think, of the sisterhood. We have Amelia Ducard, of course.
Lovely.
No named women in Master Mandragora. Eldred?
Yeah, all right. She
and
counts.
I keep going to say Miss Paget. Miss Jackson, thank you.
So we're up to 10.
We're up to 10.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. Deadly Assassin, Nut. Face of Evil, Nut. Pilot Toos. Zilda.
The Ghoul Woman?
Well, she doesn't get named. I'm only counting named women.
All right. So we'll does the prostitute get named?
She's
probably called Elsie or Edith or something.
Oh, one of the cleaners gets named.
Okay.
Actually, you know what? Let's be generous. Count women with dialogue. So let's also have the High Minister.
Oh, yeah. The computer in...
let's not go too...
No, I wouldn't count a computer.
They haven't been seen on screen.
So seen on screen with dialogue. So we have the prostitute in Talons of Wing Chiang. We have the cleaner.
The cleaner doesn't say anything.
Oh, okay.
They laugh, that's
all. The ghoul. Okay, so 14.
14 women.
In 17 stories.
Yep.
It's really poor. And, like, I'm not being quota guy or anything.
Yeah.
It's just less entertaining. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a sausage fest. It's like watching the Hobbit films. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just tiresome.
We should do Picks of the Week.
That's our best Jenny Laird Award for a long time, though.
Yeah, where are the women?
Yeah, well done.
Where are the women?
I've got two.
So do I.
Well, I'll start because I don't really have any. But I would go with Big Finish, Jago and Lightfoot. I think that's their entire series. Mm. And I think anything with Pamela Salmon is my pick of the week. So, you know, maybe a thing called Remembrance of the Daleks.
She's fabulous in that.
Yeah. Yep.
She has a great cardigan in that.
You know, she's got great hair. She's just great.
And she's also back in Big Finish as well with Countermeasures.
Oh, yes. And you could watch that episode of Blake 7 that she's in. She's in Cygnus Alpha.
Well, I have seen that. She looks fabulous in that too. Yeah. Oh, look, just send it, you know, just write in the commentary, you know, Todd, this is where you should be watching Pamela, you know. Pamela, even, you know, you could also just comment on our blog.
Yeah.
My two. One's very short. It'll be up on the website. It's called East Asians React to Yellowface.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So it's put together by BuzzFeed. So it's some of their editorial team who are Asian watching Yellowface. So specifically there's Marlon Brando. There's Mickey Rooney in Breakfast at Tiffany's. And there is even someone from Cloud Atlas in 2012. And they not only do they watch the scenes and sort of have their immediate reactions filmed, they also discuss how it makes them feel, how it made them feel as children to watch these sorts of characters, and how they're surprised that, in a way, it's still happening. My other pick, which is a bit more Doctor Who related, Talons of Wang Chiang was another Robert Holmes script, which was a last-minute rewrite of a concept that Robert Banks Stewart was meant to be turning into a script. So on the back of Terror of the Zygons and Seeds of Doom, he was going to write a story called Foe from the Future, which gets name-checked in the dialogue of Talons. Foe from the Future has been recorded by Big Finish. It's available in the Fourth Doctor Lost Stories box set. And it does have some similar concepts, but it is a wildly different story. And in terms of concept, I might even say a superior one.
That's in terms of concept, but what about in execution?
You know what, in execution, it is not as unique as Talons, because it's a lot more rooted in the science fictional world. but it does use science fiction ideas that Doctor Who hasn't used before. I don't want to say too much. And it's got possibly my favourite closing line from Tom of any of his performances on TV or on audio, but I won't say what it is because I'll spoil it for you.
Are there any women in it?
There are.
Excellent.
And there is in fact a very proactive female character from the present, not from the future, but she plays a big part in the plot, and when the Doctor and Leela get separated, she sort of becomes de facto companion, if you like. So yeah, The Foe from the Future, it's in a box set along with Valley of Death. It may even be on sale at the moment, I'm not sure. But yeah, check that out on the Big Finish website.
Well, I have two as well. One is the podcast Down and Safe, which is a Blake 7 podcast where four people are watching Blake 7 all the way through in a sort of crazy podcast concept. They're from all sorts of different places, like Canada and America and so on. There are women in it, so Hinchcliffe fans probably won't enjoy it. But it's really, really terrifically fun. I really enjoy it. They're putting out an episode twice a week, and you can find them at downandsafe.com. My second one, and I'm conscious that this is now going to be a few weeks ago that this was released, but a few months ago, Brendan and I appeared on the Trust Your Doctor podcast, and since then, they've been speaking to other podcasts, Brendan. And so,
very, very hurt.
Yeah, it is heartbreaking. So they teamed up with the guys from the Crinoid podcast and did an episode on Revenge of the Cybermen. And it's definitely worth a listen as well. You can find the Trust Your Doctor podcast, which will have done a few episodes since then, at decorativevegetable.com.
Well, dear listeners, that is all the time we have for Talent of Wang Chiang for season 14 and for Philip Hinchcliffe. Robert Holmes will be sticking around for a few more stories, though. We will be back next week when we embark on Graham Williams' first season in the role, season 15. Now, Todd, you're going to be disappearing for about 6 weeks and then joining us again for The Key to Time.
Oh, hooray.
Thank you.
I know, right? So, Nathan, next season, you will be handling the horror of Fang Rock.
Which is just tiresome.
I was going to say hooray!
And digging yourself a hole in Underworld.
Yeah, I'm excited about that.
Richard, if you're listening, you are doing The Invisible Enemy and The Sunmakers. Which leaves me with Image of the Fendal and possibly my favourite Gallifrey story, The Invasion of Time. Todd, when you rejoin us for season 16, you will be piloting the Pirate Planet.
Okay.
And the Armageddon Factor.
We can't win them all.
Do I get Androids of Tara?
Meanwhile, Nathan, you get the Stones of Blood and Power of Kroll.
No. I like Power of Kroll. I'm the only one.
Yep. No, I like it too.
Okay. And that leaves me with Rybos Operation and the Androids of Tara.
Which are the two best stories. Are you sure you didn't rig the randomizer, Brendan?
Well, I did. You remember how Richard was allowed to have the massacre because it was his favourite? Androids of Tara is actually my favourite ever Doctor Who story.
Oh, good on you.
Yeah, so that was my pick. Until next week, dear listener, please find us on Facebook, Twitter and iTunes. And also, please share us with everyone you know and love, retweet us, leave us a review, or if you haven't enjoyed our podcast, share us with your enemies. I'm sure they'd enjoy that. But until then, thank you very much for listening, and good night.
Good night.
See you soon.
I almost mentioned, but the conversation went away from it, Futurama where no fan has gone before, where, when you were talking about scientific explanations. I don't know if you've seen this
Like
Futurama
a simple
episode.
Analogy.
Yeah. It's got most of the cast of original Trek in it playing themselves.
Mm. Except for James Doohan, who wouldn't do it, so he's replaced by Welshie. But there's a point where they're trying to get away from an energy being, and Fry says,
If this were an episode of Star Trek, someone would come up with a complicated solution that can be easily explained with a simple analogy. And Leela says, if we feed the ship's energy into the creature, it'll break down his matrix. And Fry says, like putting too much air in a balloon. So as we've been making our way through Next Gen, every time Geordi does that, Rod and I just say, like putting too much air in a balloon.
It's really good. It has like an energy being kidnaps them and makes them do a like Star Trek convention. Yeah. And you've got George Takei saying, I've been to enough Star Trek conventions. You know, I know how to spell Melvar.
Yes. I didn't print enough scripts, so Walter and George will have to share. Yeah.
It's really good. Another great science fiction show cancelled before its time.
Again.
Okay.